Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
It's our second podcast of the week, which is too many. This is just us together. Nothing personal, but like we're only supposed to do this once.
That's true. It seems excessive. I don't know if we can claim this is a first, Jason. Do you think this is the first time
a
podcast has been recorded?
Entirely on iPads, using iPad OS 26?
Possibly.
Breaking new ground here. Ridiculous hoops to record this on our individual iPads in Discord using the local recording feature of iPad OS 26 Beta 1, Developer Beta 1.
It sounds dumb when you put it that way.
And yet, I feel like if anybody was going to do it, it was going to be us.
That seems plausible.
If it sounds weird, we're sorry. Welcome to the Developer Beta Summer. It's here. It's here right now.
Well, I will say, the thing that I noted when I installed this earlier in the week, and as you pointed out elsewhere, is there's no input gain control. I plugged in your ATR2100 when we were in Cupertino, and super loud because there's no way to change the gain on that mic. There's no hardware way, and there's no software in iPad OS 26. So now I'm recording, as I think you are, also with a Shure MV7, which has gain control built in.
Hardware, so we can adjust that. Hardware volume and gain control. Yeah, and balance.
But it was weird because I was like, I plugged it in. It's like, oh, you should use headphones let us know if you're not using headphones. And I was like, oh, no. There's nowhere to plug in my headphones on the iPad. And I remembered this on the headphone jack
on the mic
because I never use it because I have an interface.
I see. Yeah. It's weird. I'm sitting here to do you maybe one better. I am sitting here in front of my studio display in the back bedroom.
Oh.
With Discord in one window and Safari in another window and an external keyboard and trackpad.
Is your mic then plugged into the studio display?
Studio display, yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, right?
That's trippy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it works. I don't know what to say. It works.
I guess. I mean, it's just a USB hub, really. I mean, there's no reason it shouldn't, I guess.
Other than the whole, it's power? An iPad running a developer beta. But other than that, why wouldn't it work?
You know, that's table stakes right there.
Yeah, it's beta summer. I mean, we're trying these things, but it felt like we needed to do this because this is a feature for us. I mean, this is a feature that a lot of podcasters have been asking for and video people for a while. The idea that, for those who don't know already, the idea that most podcasts are not, even though you use Zoom or Discord or whatever to record them, the final version that comes out is assembled from local recordings because the version that goes over the internet so that everybody can hear you talk is degraded in quality. And if you're doing an edit, it's also generally, not always, this is why we actually use Zoom, but it's generally one file, which means you can't kind of like cut out when somebody coughs in the background because that cough is just in the recording. So for various reasons, for quality, for editing reasons, you want a local recording. Zoom, just as an aside, is actually kind of awesome in that Zoom gives you a individual recording from everybody on the call. So you can do that edit. And that is literally why we use Zoom so much, because it gives you a fallback. But it's still a cloud recording. It's still a highly compressed.
Yeah.
Like Mike and I do upgrade on Riverside now, and our video version comes out of Riverside. And Riverside is streaming video to us while we record. But like that's not the video that gets used in the production because in the background it's uploading the full quality version that was recorded locally, and that's not doesn't need to be synchronous. I don't need to, you know.
Right.
That's the difference, is that the high quality version can't be sent in real time generally, but it doesn't matter as long as you end up with it at the end.
Yeah, and so what I was gonna say was one of the nice things about Zoom, right, is it's always, that's a great safety net. I recently recorded an episode of Inconceivable, and one of our panelists was having some audio problems at the beginning, and eventually, you know, came on, they sounded okay, and then when I got their own personal recording, it was real bad.
Oh,
and I was like, I don't, like a wrong mic or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went and used and checked. I was like, they sounded okay during the recording. And I went and looked at the Zoom recording that I fortunately had saved just for his track. and was like, yeah, this sounds way, like, it's not perfect, but it sounds way better. Yeah, so yeah. I ended up using the Zoom track instead.
Zoom does some amazing things.
It really
I have used the Zoom track over the local track before because Zoom does some really amazing dynamics processing to remove background noise.
Yes.
And it was a very noisy location, and I realized that Zoom did a better job than it would have taken me a long time to come close to what
Zoom already
did
that work.
Moment.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
The challenge we're going to have here is like thinking about our workflows. Like right now, as we point out, because we very nicely have one of our Six Colors members recording this, we don't have a backup. Right, we only have our own local recording.
Right.
So if one of our recordings fails. We don't have anything.
That's because we're on Discord. If we were on Zoom, we would have a cloud recording.
Then the problem is that with Zoom, we have no easy way from our iPads to live stream it because there's no routing
also,
to get this into Discord.
Also true, right? For the Six Colors podcast, that would be an issue.
And there's no way with a internal... This framework is very limited, and there's no way for it to say, I can't record your end of the call. Right, I can't like with Audio Hijack. Right, so yes, again, if you're using Zoom, you can get some of that out of it for free. But it's not quite a perfect solution, but it is a lot better than what was there last week.
I would say that the thing that I was envisioning, and this actually takes us back because I think we did this. We may have done this for Six Colors. Actually, I remember you were in Seattle, I think, for a convention,
mm-hmm.
and I called you like on your phone.
On the phone, yeah.
And we did a thing on the phone. And I thought, this is where this is going to be really cool. Is because this does work on the iPhone as well. You're going to be able to take somebody with, you know, you could go with that ATR other than the gain issue or some other simple small microphone, USB microphone. Plug it into your iPhone. Get on Zoom on the iPhone.
Yeah.
Record yourself. Do an entire podcast and then send the local recording. And all you had to bring was a microphone. Like you don't even need to bring an iPad, just your phone and you can record it. And for podcasts, I would say you could talk about like radio news. Like there are lots of places where like radio people right now, well, they don't use VoIP as much, but like the idea, because like Ferrite, which I rave about on the iPad as an audio editor, it works on the iPhone too. Like it's small, but like you could totally I know that that's one of the people who, one set of users for Ferrite is radio journalists who go out in the field and do a lot of recording and then they edit on Ferrite on their iPhone and then they send the file back to the studio. And it's like, that's bananas, but like you can do it. So it's going to be a good expansion. And, you know, a lot of podcasters who write about iPad and talk about iPad, one of the issues has always been, like, I can't just go with my iPad if I'm recording a podcast. And like, I've got a trip coming up in July where we're going to like a lake in Wisconsin with some friends. And like, I think I'm going to just bring my iPad, right? Like I think even if I have a podcast to record at some point, which hopefully I don't, but like I could just throw in a microphone and do that. And that's great. It's a win. It's, you know, it's not a huge thing, but for us it's huge. And so this is why we're doing it. You know, I could tick off a bunch of other things about it. Have you spent much time? I mean, like I'm doing what I did now, which is plug it into my external display, and using the new windowing stuff. You were doing it right away when we were still in Cupertino. So, you know, you have any reactions to sort of like how that process has gone?
I've spent some time with it, and it's pretty solid. I'm surprised. I think as I mentioned when we were talking on our backstage hangout. This week for some of our members, you know, the windowing system is not as robust in the sense that like on the Mac, arbitrarily resizable windows have been the thing forever. So all apps are built understanding that they are going to get resized in essentially an infinite number of sizes. On the iPad, traditionally you've dealt with windows with size classes where it's like, okay, is this what resolution is display? Is this on? Is it a phone app? Is it an iPad app? And so, you know, at times reflowing stuff as you like are resizing a window looks a little jankier, I think, just because that's not the way the system used to work. But other than that, which is, I think, more aesthetic than actually anything usability related, it works remarkably well. I mean, again, as Craig joked during the keynote, like, wow, where do we come up with this idea, right? Like, and we have been saying this for years, like, you already cracked this, right? There is an argument, as I think you and I were talking about at some point, like, there's an argument to saying, let's rethink our assumptions and rethink how we've decided, you know, 40 years of the Mac, and this is the way we've always done stuff. And, you know, it's great to bring out to the iPad to act as a, hey, what if we were starting today? And, like, how would we approach that? Could we find a better solution? That's a perfectly valid approach. But it also means not being dogmatic about rejecting things just because they are the things that came before. And in this particular case, they really kind of contorted themselves into circles for years trying to figure out another way to do it. And some of that was limitations of hardware power, right? Before they started putting, like, the M1s and stuff in these. Yeah, you can make an argument, not enough hardware power, not enough RAM, et cetera.
It was a little early. Yeah.
Exactly. But now that you have the hardware capability, and as we've been saying for the last several years, it's the same chip, right? It's essentially the same hardware as a MacBook Air. There's no argument left for them to do it. And so I think, you know, I'm sure this took a while, and maybe this was been in the works, as some of the suggestions have been, for a couple years, and it just took them, you know, this sounds long like to ship it. But I think for all of that, it works remarkably well. And it is weird, as I think we also both were commenting at one point, to just have some of these things that are Mac staples suddenly on the iPad where they never were before, right? Like, you and I both commented, like, hey, we're trying to find some command in an app, and we're like, oh, just, there's a menu bar. Let's just go in the menu bar. You're like, amazing. Brilliant. What? Yeah. So that line between the iPad and the Mac is blurrier than ever. But, you know, to the point of those who were worried for years that Apple would make the Mac more and more like the iPad, they went in the 180-degree opposite direction and made the iPad more like a Mac without, I think, sacrificing what makes the iPad good in and of itself.
I kind of want to say that it's confidence, although I think it also could be dogma. I wrote about this yesterday. This is the Apple gets over its hangups.
Right.
It is the distinct areas of the iPad. I think the sense I got was basically the Mac is good at this. Why would we not just do it like the Mac? I where for a while, like, and again, I appreciate the idea of, like, maybe there's a new way to do this, but if the new way is not as good, I think, and also I think what happened, I'm just spitballing here, but here's a theory. I think the fear of ruining it for the most common use case, which is a legitimate fear, but I think the fear of ruining it for the most common use case got in the way of making a new use case. And I think, look, there's still people out here who are saying that even now, even this week. But, like, I think the iPad having the ability in a different mode to have Mac-style windowing doesn't break single window mode. And what you want is to not make... In fact, it's and in 26, it's actually less accidental because you can't accidentally drag things into split view or slide over. You have to go to control center and engage this different mode. And, like, I understand the fear because most people use the iPad in single window mode. In fact, for the last couple of days, since my main iPad is now running this thing and I have a backup, but I haven't needed it because it's been pretty stable. Most of the time I'm in single window mode because when I'm just looking at RSS and, like, I don't need to manage windows in that mode. It's fine. But then
you
that mode is there. I think they were just afraid. I think they're like, oh no, we'll ruin it for everybody if we make it complex. So let's make it differently complex. Like, it didn't make, it was kind of incoherent. And now they're just like, okay, let's just, the Mac already solved this. Let's just do that. And that's what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. Like, you know, I was flashing back while you were talking about the single window mode to the fact that the very first version of Mac OS X had a single window mode that was kind of a precursor in some ways, like, oh, you could only have, like, one window open at a time, which for the Mac in 2001 was a weird and bananas idea. It's like, but the whole point is I can have all these apps open. Why would I ever want to do that?
It was kind of a precursor to the new full screen mode that they ended up introducing. But it's also
a good cousin
of the traffic lights, right? It's the purple,
The purple
gem on the other side.
The purple button. The purple traffic light button, which means, according to my son, dance.
Oh, good. So, I like that.
Yeah, that's what it means. Stop.
Awesome.
Slow down. Go dance.
Dance.
So, yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed with everything I have used so far, just from the standpoint of the controls and the windowing. I think it's remarkable. And it is, you know, I had that moment, too, where I was sitting there like, oh, man, I wish I had a magic keyboard. And then I made a snarky comment about wanting iPad mirroring, and everyone reminded me you could just use universal control, which I also was like, yeah, I forgot because I never use it because I'm almost always using my iPad somewhere in lieu of using my laptop. Right. And I forgot that I was sitting there at a desk with a laptop, and I just like mouse over. I was like, oh, now I can use all those things, which was just very weird. But now that the lines have become a little more blurred, like you said, you're over there using a display, an external keyboard, an external trackpad. Like, you're just gonna get rid of that MacBook Pro, go iPad only, one iPad. You can have it at home. You can have it away.
I don't think that is gonna happen. But it's an interesting. I mean, it's an interesting thought. I literally just because I've set up my old Mac Studio back here, running the beta as well, and I literally just unplugged the Thunderbolt plug from the Mac Studio and plugged it into the iPad, and it's like, okay, now I'm using the iPad. There's a lot of complexity there, but but I don't know. I mean. It's I think I'm less likely to use it in external display mode than I am to use it in the Magic Keyboard.
Right, right. This is an idea I was thinking about this week, because one of the other things that we talked about a lot in the run up to WWDC was the whole like, just give me a Mac on the iPad, right? Which is not quite what they did. They borrowed elements. But it did make me think as I was sitting there and thinking, well, you've got the stoplight widgets. You got the menu bar, right? Like, you got multiple windows. And I started thinking, like, well, you know, we have that whole system where you can run iPad apps on the Mac. And it made me wonder about the idea of, like, a reverse of that system. Like, what if there were a way to, like, not quite sideload, but, like, what if you could be, like, I have this app on the Mac. And, like, it's basically runs more or less like it does on the iPad. Could I run a Mac app on the iPad in the same way I can run an iPad app on my Mac?
This is a really interesting idea, and it's almost, I mean, it's like coherency mode in Parallels, or to throw it way back, it's Blue Box in Mac OS X. It's classic, actually, classic mode, where if people weren't around then, I should say, don't remember. I mean, if you're old enough to remember it, you maybe don't remember it, but that was this idea that... early days of OS X, it would basically boot OS 9 in a virtual container in the background, but it wouldn't show it as a window. It would show the windows of the app.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was a little weird, but you could do it. And I have had that same thought, but it's a really great idea now, which is what's stopping them from making a Mac app compatibility mode?
Yeah.
Where those apps run in this windowing mode. Because they've got menu bars. I mean, I think what's stopping them is that there's a lot of overhead with that, and they'd really rather people make an iPad app instead, right?
Or a universal app that runs on both. But it is, you know, it certainly made me think, like, I mean, then the main thing that's holding you back is, like, whether the developers are going to support all this stuff.
Right.
And they will for a lot of the iPad stuff, but, like, you know, and obviously there's limitations in terms of what frameworks are available on the different platforms because it still isn't parity there. But
yeah, and there's security issues.
You can't just drag over Audio Hijack, right? Like, yeah, that's not going to work.
You'd be running a Mac virtual machine on an iPad, which is probably something Apple doesn't actually want you to do. But it certainly, from an interface perspective, becomes a lot less weird.
Right.
Now.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's the same thing with the comments, you know, in previous years, people talk about, you couldn't really do a touchscreen Mac because the widgets don't work right. And it's like, well, they figured that out. As I always argued, they could if they wanted to, right? Like, it was never saying it was physically impossible. It was suggesting that they just couldn't change it in some way or adapt it, which is exactly what they've done here. But the menu bar works with your finger, right? Like,
it does.
No reason you couldn't do that on a Mac.
Yeah.
So I feel like you've given up any pretense other than we just don't want to do it or we're not ready to do it. But it doesn't seem like there's any technological reason they could not.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say all the work that has been done on making windowing work like the Mac on an iPad absolutely is also going to serve the decisions they make to make touchscreens work on a MacBook.
Yeah.
I think that it's the same, like, I think it's the same interface. Are you getting it yet? I think, yeah. I mean, right? I think it has to be that, like, if we're going to do this and we're going to make Mac-like windowing work with touch, it works both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that, it furthers the argument that, like, look, we don't see these devices necessarily as competitors. We just see them as, like, people have different preferences. And
yeah,
I do think it becomes more likely you see these products getting closer and closer together. I don't know if I'm going to go so far as to say converge, but, you know, a decade from now, who knows? They will probably be even closer than they are now, and they are pretty close right now. So
yeah.
It will be interesting. I mean, especially you look at stuff even like design-wise, right? Obviously, we haven't talked about the liquid glass, but I mean, adding into that, not just that, but the icons. Somebody has started doing some yard work outside.
Nice.
The Classic. Icons on Mac OS X, you know, a lot of people lamented the old break-in-the-box icons, and I sent you a screenshot of BB Edit running on the Tahoe beta where it was
it's
the
in
icon.
Squircle jail.
Yeah, they put everything in the squircles, and I'm like, that's obnoxious. But I mean, you know, sooner or later they'll all get redesigned, but they look exactly like iPad and iPhone app icons, right? The lines have blurred even further. So
it is
fascinating to see how that continues to move closer and closer together, because the argument is, it's great that the design is consistent and it makes it easier to move back and forth across these devices, but you can make the same exact argument for the interfaces, right? So we'll see how that continues.
Yeah, I have written nothing about liquid glass yet, in part because I really want to experience it and I also want to think about it. And I also want to let it sit, because everybody's got, I mean, it's the internet, right? Like, everybody's got a hot take, and I just, right or wrong, and I'm not saying people who are criticizing it are wrong at all. First off, it's an opinion, but second, like, the issues they're pointing out may well be really legitimate issues. But what I will say is, in my opinion, if you've seen it or maybe even used it for a day, it's impossible for any human being to react to it objectively and override the human sense of rejecting anything that's different. And I'm not interested in takes that are pointing out obvious drawing errors in a developer beta. I'm not really even interested in takes that are like, aha, I've solved the whole thing and this is why it's bad on day two. Because as accomplished as you might be as a designer or commentator or critic or whatever, like, I think anything that's changed like this, you are better served to wait and think about it a little bit. Like, clearly there are things in it that are bad. Sure. I am not yet ready to declare the ideas bad over the implementation. I'm still thinking about it. Certainly, there are lots of places where it's implemented badly, and obviously, I mean, they better fix them. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like a glaring bug, essentially. It's like, this has to be fixed, and like, macOS is especially disastrous.
Well, and trying to navigate that line between what is a bug and what is just an implication of what they've decided to do, right? Like, I had that moment. I think I posted it somewhere this morning, maybe in our Discord, like, I happened to have the messages window partially scrolled down the messages list, and it made this weird blob where it's like, for a second I looked at it and thought, that's clearly a bug. It rendered badly. And then I looked closer at it. It's like, no, I understand exactly how that ended up where it is. It's like, I was highlighting a pinned thing. The pinned thing went underneath the search bar, but it ended up with this weird set of overlapping colors and shapes. And I'm like, that is a choice. And that is the natural fallout of the way that you have chosen to implement this. And I don't think it looks good, but I also understand it's not a bug. It's just like, there's a lot of moving pieces.
But I think when that stuff comes out, that's going to be a good example of them ideally they will see that stuff and go, oh, right, like unintended consequence of this. And maybe it leads, right? Because that's why you do a public beta.
Absolutely.
And a developer beta. It's not, I mean, you could do it and say, well, this is just to get everybody else ready, but we're marching in lockstep and we're done. But I think that even inside Apple, they're like, what did we not anticipate? What did we not think about?
Right.
You absolutely found that. I think the other, I'm going to make a bunch of human nature observations, I guess, because the other thing I'm going to say is I've noticed a lot of people, especially people predisposed to be angry, I will say. I read a piece this morning. I skimmed. I couldn't read it all. It was very long. A piece this morning that will go unnamed that was very clearly somebody who has basically fessed up to it. I admire that, saying, I have hated Apple's design direction for years. I think they're going in the wrong way. I think they make terrible decisions, and this is also terrible. I'm like, well, at least, I mean, it's a real dog bites man there. Person who doesn't like Apple's design philosophy continues to not like Apple's design philosophy. But what I will say is a lot of people really get bunched up about the design storytelling that goes on when they roll out a new design in a keynote. And this is why, like, I know, I hate it too. What I'll tell you, as somebody who's been a participant in a lot of redesigns and has also witnessed a lot of redesigns in other contexts, this is a thing that people do now, is they do storytelling about a design. The storytelling happens after the fact. It's for marketing reasons. There are probably some ugly and complex things. I mean, there's certainly ugly and complex things going on in the trenches trying to figure out how a design works. And Apple doesn't want to talk about that. They want to talk about highfalutin philosophy. And here's my parallel. I read a site called UniWatch, which is great. It is a blog about uniforms, about sports uniforms. So, like, there's a new uniform for the City Connect uniform for the Colorado Rockies, and they write a whole story about what it is. Or there's a new city uniform for the Golden State Warriors, and they talk about, like, all the details. But one of the things that I've noticed over the last few years is every one of those rollouts comes with this huge, ludicrous marketing document doing storytelling about, like, why is it that shade of gray? And, oh, the gray represents the fog in San Francisco. And the tag at the bottom has three stripes that represent the three initial owners of the team. And you're like, what are you doing? This is bananas. Why?
It's not the American flag, man. Like,
So what I will say is, for people who are really mad about how Apple described this in the keynote, just let it go. Let it out of your head. Because that's PR. That's storytelling. And, like, the storytelling, I don't know. I guess somebody likes it somewhere, feels that it's necessary. But I will tell you, from what I've learned watching all these uniform rollouts especially, like, it's meaningless. It's meaningless. And in fact, if you're trying to analyze and criticize and compliment design, the last thing you want to do is think about the storytelling, because the storytelling is artificial and it's after the fact. So put it out of your head. Like, if you want to be mad at Liquid Glass, be mad at it for legitimate reasons that are not the fact that Alan Dye is sitting there saying, oh, we made more room for your content, because that's a great example. We made more room for your content is the thing Apple's been saying for years now. And that's because what they really don't want to say is, we like using your content as background illustration for our interface, right? We like obscuring your content in blurs and shadows because it makes the whole interface look more pleasant. The idea of, like, I don't know if you noticed this, Dan, but in the music app, where the interface is like, it's a page with album art on it, and it starts at the left and goes to the right, and you can scroll. But if you bring it up in Liquid Glass, even though it starts at the left, there are more albums to the left of that, which does not make sense, but it makes a nice look in the sidebar. And in one of the videos, they say, we've got this whole thing where, like, we basically reflect or pick up your content and put it out there so that it seems more symmetric or whatever. But, like, this is what I'm saying, was when they say we make space for your content, they don't actually mean it. They mean they like using content. They like the look of a thing that looks so full and overflowing that the content is underneath other things, because it gives a sense of an infinite space that is full of stuff. And like, you can disagree with that, but like, that's what you should disagree with.
Right.
Not the
right.
cockamamie thing they said in the keynote.
Yeah. I mean, marketing is always marketing, and marketers going to market.
But people,
right?
Like,
I mean,
but people, it's like, oh, now we're hearing from the designers about their really, it's like, no, it's still PR. Just let it go. It's still nonsense marketing stuff. Just,
yeah.
That's not, don't worry about what Alan Dye says in a video. Like, don't, judge them on their actions.
Yeah. I mean, if you, just thinking about that. I'm never not going to be thinking about them moving all the pieces of glass around on the table.
I know, right?
What designers do all day. Everybody knows that.
That's what they do.
That's
They're
what they do. They
sit there with
holding,
lenses.
Thoughtfully holding pieces of glass. What were the directors telling them in that moment? I need you to hold this piece up and then really look like you're thinking about it hard.
You know, at the observatory, yeah. which I got to go in this
yeah,
week.
Same. Yeah,
for the first time. Oh, yeah. There's that big hello in glass.
Yes. Yep.
And I thought, yep. I thought, well, you know,
so
really
weird.
Lean into this glass thing
so
now, aren't
weird.
We?
It was very funny to me. Also, they wouldn't let us, they would only let us take pictures from a certain angle. I didn't take one, but they were telling the other people in my group, like, if you want to take pictures, they're like, you have to take it from that hallway that you enter in and nothing beyond that.
I did take a picture
Oculus.
In the observatory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you took a sneaky picture?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was almost in the hallway because I just wanted to shoot sort of back through the room and then out to the
yes.
view.
Yeah,
but I had forgotten that they told me not to take a picture, and nobody yelled at me. So
that's right. It's already been deleted from your phone. You didn't even know it.
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, yeah. So you know, beta one is beta one as well. I mean, I'm using a lot of tautologies now, but like, it is the earliest version of this. Stuff will change. There's always a question of how much it changes, right? Because I think there's years where we've seen significant revisions, and I think there's years where they're like, nope, that's what we meant, and that's what we're sticking to. And we don't yet know how far they will go in terms of tweaking that design. I'm sure there will be some, but, you know, it may be one of those things where, like, I mean, iOS 7 is a great example, right? Like, iOS 7 went even further than this. It was the even more radical change from iOS 6. And over the course, like the following years, the design kept getting tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. And that may happen. I'm sure that will happen, right? iOS 29 is not going to look like iOS 26. It will be more refined because they're not going to be like, we nailed it. Day one, got it all right. It's going to evolve. The question is, how much of this evolution is happening over the next 3 months, and how much of this evolution is happening over the next 3 years? And probably some of both is my guess. There are definitely places I look at the glass and think to myself, it's a bit much, isn't it? And there are other places where I think I think this is an interesting and useful and even attractive look, but. You know, I think that it's a balance of all those different elements. And as you said, there's things that are unintended or they don't test on every single app or every single combination of things. They'll never do as much as all the millions of users will. So it's just how they respond to that, I think, is one of the challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of my things are basically like, hey, stop and think about it a little. And like, if somebody feels the pressure to react, or if somebody's really been on their case for a long time and views this as just a continuation of their existing diatribes, I mean, okay, I guess. But like, I think there are probably good things about this interface, and there are probably bad things about this interface. I do think that I do question some of their decisions when they say we want to get the Chrome out of the way and focus on your content, that... that feels like a dogmatic response at Apple design, and I'm not sure I agree with it. Like, I'm not sure I agree that this focus on your content and hide UI leads to good user experience, and that some of this stuff, like the infinite content behind things, is more motivated by it looking good than it being usable. But I also accept the fact that Apple could make the most usable operating system in the world. And, you know, Harry McCracken keeps posting things from his interview with Jeff Raskin in 1999. And boy, Jeff Raskin was an angry guy about Apple interfaces after he left Apple. But, like, Apple could make the most usable interface in the world. And I'm telling you, it would be ugly. And there are people out there who are like, who cares if it's ugly? It's just a computer interface. Make it ugly and usable. And I think the answer is people do care. David Smith has now built an entire business on aesthetics on an iPhone through WidgetSmith. Like, people do care. They do care how it looks. There is a disconnect between people who want pure functionality and people who want aesthetics. And Apple has to please a giant audience. And part of that is their image. And that means it's never going to be as usable as it could be. That's the truth. Sorry, but it's true. So instead, it's like, how do they balance it? And do they make good decisions or not?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and
I define the mute button on my thing because I can't mute this thing because I'm on an iPad. Anyway,
there's another weakness.
Yikes.
We'll see how it goes. I think that most of the capabilities added in the iPad and the Mac this year are good.
Great.
I have some questions about the interface. This also links into that thing I wrote the other day while I was on a plane about Apple being more open to people holding on to the previous interfaces, right? Like,
yes, yes, yes. You can just go back if you don't like it. Like, this started with mail, right? With that mail organization thing. I said, a toggle.
You could go further, right? I said, like, it was also true in Safari when they moved the address bar to the bottom. You could move back to top. If you want to go way back, I referenced natural scrolling, right? If you want to.
There are still people,
John Sarkisian, who like to keep things in the old style of scrolling. But it's generally less the case with, like, the way things look. Apple has always been a very... Like if you don't like it, go buy a PC, right? Like, or buy an Android device or whatever. And so I think they've gotten, you know, enough blowback. And also, as I said, I think it's a tacit admission that our devices are so important to us that you can't just any change that gets made that's especially on the level of let's change this entire interface is going to alienate and frustrate some people, especially those even, you know, with the Mac. 20 years ago, even though a lot of people were using them, most people, I think, had a little bit more technological literacy if you were using one of these devices, whereas literally everybody has a smartphone. And if you change the device for, like, all these people, there is a large percentage of them are going to be like, I literally don't know where anything is anymore how to use this phone that's so critical to my everyday life.
That's the lesson of iOS 7 more than anything was. They plowed over a bunch of people who did not want change. And a lot of people are like now just incredibly suspicious even now of any software update that happens. And so you end up with curmudgeons who are like, well, that's it. I'm never updating my Mac software, my iPad software, whatever again. And I'm like, okay, I mean, sure. All right. It is. It dovetails well with my story that I wrote a few years ago about discoverability and the fact that they keep wanting to add features to delight and surprise users, but nobody can find them. And everybody's just in their habits. And that's the flip side of it, too, is that Apple wants to expose, like the photos. The reason the photos interface changed in this previous cycle was because Apple has built an amazing set of features to surface your photos in intelligent ways that are not, let's scroll back through thousands and thousands of photos in a library. And people were so mad because they expected the grid with the recent photos. I'm like, I get it, because that is a very utilitarian need to grab that photo you just took. But Apple's like, yeah, but all this other stuff too. And so they made a change to highlight all the other stuff. Because I think that all the other stuff is actually pretty great. But like, there are a lot of people who just won't forgive them for it because they're like, you changed my thing. And so they've reverted that to a toggle on the iPhone where you can see the two things and therefore you can just have your grid mode and like, okay. But like, it's a real challenge. Like, how do they make things discoverable or show people things? I mean, like, because every time they throw up a little dialogue that says, would you like to check out this new feature, everybody screams like, oh no, Apple, get out of my way. But it's like, well, how else are people going to find out about the new features if they don't know that? Every time I show somebody the fact that you can shuffle your lock screen between photos of specific people in your life, take all the photos of your kid and every day there's a new one or every hour there's a new one on your lock screen, people are like, whoa, how do you get that? I want that. And it's right. Well, I mean, it's been there for 4 years now, but nobody knows about it. So it's really hard, like, because these are that is the downside of Apple's success is they made these kind of universal products, and the user base is not universal. So what do you do? And yeah, you want people to try your new thing, but if they're really angry about it, Apple's like, all right, go back to the old thing. Whatever. I don't care. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I find that fascinating because it's rare that you get a design thing where design is like, you know, we like this, but like you can use this too, right? Like design tends to be something that's a little more prescriptive. Whereas this takes a more descriptive approach to this is how people are using things. And so let's adopt to or adapt to the way people are using things rather than telling them how they have to use it. And that's I think that's good. It's just un-Apple-like.
Yeah. Shelley Brisbane pointed out that in iOS 7, the affordances for accessibility were a lot less than they are now. And I've seen some people argue that if you have to rely on accessibility settings to make your design work, you failed. And I mean, that statement I agree with, but I disagree with the people who make statements like that. Because the point of the accessibility, and also there's this attitude like if you have to use an accessibility feature, you failed. And it's like, I mean, we could argue whether accessibility is the right place to put some of these. And you could call them design options or whatever. But Apple has chosen to call them accessibility fields. But there should be no stigma in using accessibility. In fact, I would say a smart modern design would be created with those settings in mind, which this was, by the way. There are sessions about it at the WWDC videos. They have built this with the thought to what various accessibility controls do to alter this interface. I think that's smart because I think if there's part of this interface that bugs you and you can turn that part off, that's good, right? And not to be too aggressive here, but I'm just going to say it. I get a sense from some of these people, like what they really want is for it to change to serve them, and they don't care about anybody else. And like, right. Options are good. And people being angry because they have to turn an option on, when what I would say is, if everybody has to turn that option on, it's a problem. If a small number of people turn that option on because they just can't stand the animations or the, you know, reduced opacity or whatever, like, it's a balance. But like, ideally, those controls, whether they're in accessibility or in some other setting, ideally, those controls are part of the whole idea of the interface so that people can set, like, oh, I don't like this. This is too much for me. And it's not a toggle, like, go back to the old interface, but it's kind of like, yeah, I would prefer. It's not even like I can't see these things. It's like I would prefer a little more opacity. Like, okay, there's a setting for that. I'm okay with that. I think a design, like the fundamental design, should be usable for most people. Mm-hmm. I do agree. And if everybody's turning on accessibility, you failed. But I think that having a range of options for users in a design is actually good.
Yeah. And I also agree. I think Syracuse wrote this, and I thought it was a good point. It did make me think a lot. It kept
still
thinking
there?
In my head. Oh, sorry. Did you...
Oh, no.
Nope.
What happened to Dan?
Sorry, I got muted. It's cool.
Oh, okay. It's all fine here. We're fine. How are you?
We also discovered what happens when you get a phone call in the middle of a podcast, which is to say it showed up as a notification on my iPad and stopped my recording. So you're going to have more than one file. Sorry.
Neat.
Yeah, that's fun. I didn't even answer it. I don't know why it stopped the recording.
You got to go and do not disturb or something.
It's a problem. It's my wife, so she punches through that usually.
Oh, she breaks through?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
What I was going to say was that there was I think Syracuse made a comment about this, and it's stuck in my head since then, which is he said something about, like, you know, the affordances for turning on accessibility, but why is it you have to choose between having an accessible interface and a beautiful interface? Shouldn't a beautiful interface be accessible? And I kept thinking about that because I was like, you know, he's not wrong. It does feel like, yes, there are always some affordances that are going to be made for accessibility. There aren't necessarily things that people, you know, who don't need those affordances are going to want, right? I think about things where it highlights certain elements on the screen, like, okay, put all those buttons in boxes or changes things for people who have colorblindness, right? Like, that may be an effect that most people don't want, but will be very useful to people who need it. But the idea that we have turned some of these functions into things that accessibility can, you know, essentially get rid of these things that are more aesthetic than anything does make me think a little bit like, have we gone too far into creating things if by nature of their very appearance, they require to be disabled for accessibility? Like, it's an interesting conundrum, and I don't know. I've just been thinking about it a lot because I thought it was an astute point.
That's the gray area between the two things I was describing, right? Which is, if you make a design that people like, but that some people dislike and they can turn parts of it off, that's good. If you make a design that everybody has to go to the settings and fix, that's bad.
Yeah.
In between, there's a lot of room for debate about, like, if we make this default less, is that good for everybody?
Yeah.
And I think there are certainly things in liquid glass where that feels like it's the case, where, like, this is too much. You need to bring it back. I haven't spent enough time with it, but, like, I would like Apple to stop trying to make the transparent Mac toolbar happen.
Yeah, right?
I don't understand it. I don't understand. They've tried it, and it doesn't work, and they're going to do it again.
They keep doing it. It's funny. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the technology, the computer vision technology to detect what's behind things and alter what you see based on knowing what's behind is more advanced now. So the argument that, like, the things in your menu bar will actually adapt to readability. I'm not sure Apple understands what readability is, by the way. This is the problem with this scenario is they're like, oh, well, now we'll make it black text. Now we'll make it white text. I'm like, you know, you might want to work on adding some opacity or adding a stroke or a drop shadow or something to increase that contrast. Like, there are other things you could do that they seem reluctant to do. And so it ends up being that way. But anyway, my point is, you could probably make an interface that's a little more adaptive now than you could 5 years ago. I'm not sure they're doing that. I think they're maybe just carting it out again and seeing if we'll accept the idea of a completely, you know, white text on a off-white background menu bar, which is not great.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's a lot to think about, which is like, I want people to think about and criticize this design because I think it's very criticizable. I just am also simultaneously really wary of people with baggage or people making snap decisions when it's like, I would love people to think about this a little bit more, because all of us are going to be shocked by the change, and you got to get over it, because, like, change isn't bad. Bad things are bad. Good things are good. Change is just a thing that human brains are like, no, push it away. And, like, if you really want to take it seriously, you got to get over that first hurdle, and then you're ready to break it down. So just like that, that's why I feel like everybody taking a few days, it's a good thing. And then use it for a few days, and then, you know, then think it through. This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, we will wrap it there. This very weird podcast that we did in unusual circumstances, sort of like the last one. Anyway, by the way, there's a video version of that one we posted on Monday. So go to YouTube or Six Colors YouTube, or just on the website. It's there, and you can check it out if you want to see us talk to each other in person, which we did. We'll be back next time. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.